Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the third week of March, and this week the House of Representatives passed a bill to reauthorize the Violence Against Women Act. This law, originally passed in 1994, created a number of federal offenses related to crimes principally against women, including domestic violence and stalking. But deterring and punishing crime is primarily a function of state and local governments, so what the law does is it provides a variety of grants to them with strings attached intended to improve the enforcement of such laws around the country. But this law lapsed in 2019 amid a partisan dispute over certain provisions, and now the House, controlled by Democrats, has passed a reauthorization with the support of the Democratic caucus plus several dozen Republicans. The question is whether there can be a bipartisan agreement in the Senate, where Republicans object to some provisions in the House bill, including about guns and the jurisdiction of tribal courts. With the narrowest of majorities in the Senate, Democrats cannot overcome a filibuster without Republican support, and this possibly sets up the Violence Against Women Act as the first major piece of legislation where the filibuster is what stops Democrats from being able to move their agenda to Joe Biden's desk. Remember, there were not 50 Democratic votes for a $15 minimum wage. To talk about this, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist at the Washington Post on the right. Hello, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
And on the left, Christine Emba, also a columnist and an editor at the Washington Post. Hello, Christine.
Hi, Josh.
So, Christine, obviously this debate over the Violence Against Women Act comes at a time that the country has just seen a horrific attack aimed at Asian American women. A man shot and killed 8 people, including 6 Asian American women, at 3 massage parlors in the Atlanta area. The suspect apparently made statements to police after his arrest to the effect that he viewed the women as an unreasonable sexual temptation. So you have two related phenomena for the government to respond to here: violence against women and concern about anti-Asian bias incidents and violence over the last year when Asian Americans have faced discrimination and abuse related to the origin in China of the global coronavirus pandemic. So what is the role here for federal leaders in the federal government?
Yeah, I mean, first, just to continue to condemn this completely horrific act and also, you know, try and identify distinguish, but also equally condemn the many threads that went into it. You know, for all of sort of the right wing's complaints about how intersectionality and theories like that are taking over our classrooms, this event is actually a perfect example of why intersectional dialogue, you know, kind of matters. This wasn't just necessarily an attack on women. It wasn't just an attack on Asian people. It was a mixture of many different factors. It was intersectional. They were Asian women and they were attacked, you know, for that reason, combined again with, you know, just general gender hatred and misogyny. The government and leaders in the government, you know, have, I would say, not been remiss on, you know, taking all of these factors into account and condemning all of these factors in different ways. But I think we're going to have to discuss a lot more about how these things intertwine, how, you know, bias against Asians can also, you know, turn to violence against women, and how, frankly, male supremacy and in some cases white supremacy can contribute to horrific crimes.
Megan, building on that, one of the key things the government does here is a policy response. But I think to Christine's point, there's value here in naming the problem. And I think there's been an oddity in the debate over intersectionality over the last few years where conservatives object to the term. But I think when you drill down and you describe what Christine has described there, intersectional oppression is a real thing. Questions about what to do about it are a somewhat separate matter. But I think it's right that this is a place to look at that, say this is what appears to have happened, and figure out what we need to do about it as a society, which includes but is not limited to government responses.
I don't have any problem with naming the ways in which different identities intersect and the ways in which that can produce real social outcomes. That said, I am actually not sure that we know what the motives were here. I think we should be careful about rushing to attribute them. We have seen this over and over again. People get out over their skis in deciding that they know what caused some of these attacks. And in some cases, they're right, right? Dylann Roof really was committing a terrible act of racial violence. But in other cases, like the Pulse nightclub, where it seemed just overwhelmingly obvious that this was a homophobic attack, subsequent reporting revealed that he didn't even know it was a gay nightclub before he went there. And then he repeatedly asked one of the bouncers, where are all the women? And so I do think that, you know, what seems obvious to the naked eye is not always the case. And I also think, you know, to take this back to the Violence Against Women Act, I'm not clear what the role of the Violence Against Women Act really is, right? I mean, it's not like we had a problem prosecuting terrible mass murderers before. I mean, as a matter of policy, I think that the Violence Against Women Act is bad policy, and it stems from a largely incorrect theory of why domestic violence happens and what is best to be done about it. And more broadly, I think that it speaks to a really troubling trend on the left of being generally in favor of decarceration and less punitive approaches to crime, except in the case of things like rape and domestic violence, in which case we get sort of the counterpart to compassionate conservatism, which is sadistic liberalism, where nothing too bad can be done to the perpetrators of these crimes, as if other crimes don't have real victims who suffer gravely. And so I think that this is a horrific case, which is definitely violence against women, and that should be prosecuted the full extent of the law, I'm actually not sure what bringing in the observation that they are women is going to tell us about what we should do about cases like this. And I'm really not sure that kind of consciousness raising about sexism, it would have in any way ever prevented an attack like this.
Well, I think it depends on who is doing the evaluating, right? I mean, this was an apparent murder of 8 people. Georgia is a death penalty state. It's very likely that prosecutors could obtain the death penalty for the perpetrator here without ever having to explore exactly why he committed these crimes. So it's not necessarily the case that the prosecutors need to explore that question. But I don't know that means that we don't need to explore that question. And I take Megan's point that we will get more information over time, and I think we can adjust our view on that over time. But again, we're not a court. And so I think, you know, while, you know, being prudent and waiting for evidence is a good practice, I think, you know, what happened with Pulse was really odd. And all of the initial reporting that, you know, ended up being, you know, incorrect in terms of Omar Mateen's motivations. And I think that fed into the prosecution of his wife in a way that was inappropriate. But I think, you know, as a general matter, I think the public needs to balance, you know, waiting for information, but also understanding societal trends that are happening in front of us, reacting to them. And that can involve making evaluations faster than a court might make them. But that said, Christine, I guess the question is, you know, to the extent that we focus more on this, we raise awareness about it, how does that translate into positive social change?
One area where the government does have very clear influence, and that was incredibly influential in this attack, is that Robert Long was upset about being kicked out of his parents' house because of his obsession with pornography and apparent sex addiction, as I think he himself has described it. The next day, he bought a gun and drove over and killed 8 people. Should it be so easy for someone to just buy a gun? This is a question that we have been, you know, debating for years at this point. And it's also one of the sticking points that Republicans seem to have against the Violence Against Women Act. It would close a boyfriend loophole that makes it harder for spouses and now perhaps boyfriends who have been convicted of domestic violence to buy weapons. Our easy access to guns is plaguing our society. It makes it so much easier for these events to take place and keep taking place, whether it's, you know, a man upset about his sexual proclivities, something that we, you know, could talk about as a society, how we make allowances for men who blame problems in their lives on women to attack women, whether it's school shooters who go and shoot kids because they're upset and it's easy to access weapons. That is a government policy that we could have a real discussion about, and in fact are trying to with this bill.
I'm not sure how the Violence Against Women Act is really, it's not like a sotto voce discussion about gun control. It's its own thing. I agree certainly that if America was not so awash in guns, we would have fewer shootings. That seems sort of mechanically has to be true. Obviously, also, as with any other civil liberty, curtailing it has costs as well as benefits, and those have to be weighed. I think that I would place a different weight on the liberty, the Second Amendment rights, than Christine obviously would. But that's kind of a separate discussion to the Violence Against Women Act, which, you know, again, just going back to the particulars of the bill, which is mostly about trying to force prosecutors to charge people who have been accused of domestic violence and other related crimes as harshly as possible, to force police to arrest them. Anyone who has been accused, even if the accuser sort of thinks the better of the accusation or doesn't want their partner arrested, wanted a lower level intervention. It is an extremely punitive, you know, hangover from the 1990s approach to law enforcement. And I have to say, as a woman, I am just disappointed that this is the area where the left has not only not been able to reassess the idea that the thing to do when you are confronted with a real societal problem of violence, to be clear, it is a big issue, that the answer to that is always to double down on being as harsh as possible to the offenders in the hope that, you know, the beatings will continue and until morale improves. I don't think that's an effective approach to crime. I think we know now that it has terrible side effects, especially for communities of color, where mass incarceration has been absolutely devastating. But it also, I think, has broader effects on the kind of society we are, and that there are more effective interventions that actually use less punishment, less kind of harsh approach, and actually have more success in reducing the underlying crimes.
Megan, I think one thing that's interesting, though, is the objection that you're raising here is really not the kernel of where the dispute between the parties is on this. We've had bipartisan deals in the past to reauthorize this law, and we'll probably get one again, I think, later this year. And Republicans have objections to some of the gun provisions about who can be tried in a tribal court and that sort of thing. But what you're objecting to is largely an area of bipartisan agreement about this law and is likely to survive intact in any negotiation over it.
Sure. I mean, look, I am not your standard Republican. I haven't voted Republican since 2004. I am not in lockstep with the conservative movement on a bunch of issues, but I do actually think that I am speaking for, luckily, what I think, you know, at least until 2020, it's sort of harder to know where we are now. But at least until 2020, was a growing sentiment on the right that mass incarceration was expensive, was unworkable, and thanks, frankly, to a lot of the work from prison ministries, was also morally unjust. And that, you know, while I, of course, wish to see women, myself included, protected from intimate partner violence, from other forms of violence that are common, and that we are more vulnerable to than men, I also want to live in a society that just generally seeks the least punitive and most restorative approach to criminal offenses, rather than something than a society that sees kind of, you know, Hulk smash as its first line defense. And I'm worried that the left has actually moved more on this one issue, has moved more in that direction than they were in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, I would just push back a little bit on that. I don't, in fact, think that the left has moved towards, you know, promoting mass incarceration for domestic violence offenses. In fact, I think you have, you know, seen the largest push against excessive incarceration coming from the left. And the Violence Against Women Act, in fact, is really closely related to the question of gun violence, at least in these examples that you describe, whether it's intimate partner violence or, you know, gender-based violence. one of the clear and stated reasons that Republicans have pushed back against this reauthorization is that the National Rifle Association is opposed to extending, the ban on gun purchasing for spouses who have been convicted of domestic violence and does not want to close the boyfriend loophole. Joni Ernst, I think, in fact, said, you know, that certainly we ran into hiccups on the gun issues, and that's, you know, a number one priority for us when she was talking about why Republicans pushed back against authorizing this bill. So gun control is a huge factor here, and that is one of the reasons why Republicans are not apparently so concerned with ending violence against women with this act, at the very least. This is a concern for them. It's not really a debate about crime and punishment in this specific bill.
Well, that doesn't make the bill a good idea. It just means that that the Republicans are not attacking it where I would, although I am also uncomfortable with the gun provisions. I basically have a pretty strong support for Second Amendment rights. But, you know, the fact that Republicans aren't attacking it effectively does not make it a good idea. They ineffectively attack a lot of things that are bad ideas.
I want to talk about one other legislative flashpoint that has emerged this week, although we're not likely to see votes on it for a few months. We're seeing the infrastructure package that President Biden hopes to move later this year start to take shape in terms of more details about exactly what it would do. And in particular, Biden has been talking about his desire for a tax increase in this package that would aim at corporations and high-earning individuals. Christine, this obviously is one additional factor that, again, they intend to do this package through the budget reconciliation process, which means that they could move it through the Senate with precisely 50 votes. But layering on a tax increase, you're going to have, you know, it's another area of negotiation where you have to get all 50 Democrats to agree and then to vote for it, which they will be attacked for in the midterm elections. With interest rates being so low and with Democrats having said repeatedly that, you know, the fact that it is so easy and cheap for the government to borrow is a reason that we don't need to pay for the relief package or other things with other spending cuts, why is it necessary to pay for this with a tax increase instead of just borrowing?
You know, that's a good question. Again, I think this may be part of a broader strategy from the Democratic Party, influenced, I think, by more left and progressive elements of the Democratic Party that seeks to put more fiscal responsibility on high earners, millionaires and billionaires, those who presumably have earned a lot of money from the United States and do not, I think, in the eyes of many Democrats, seem to be paying their fair share. I think there's, you know, a natural pushback from both parties to wanting to raise taxes on the middle class or working class. It just seems, and I think plays easier, to say that we're taxing the wealthy to fund some of these things. But I also think that those worries about deficits are fair. And I mean, we actually have heard those from both sides of the aisle. If there are members of society who, in fact, would be benefiting from the latest infrastructure week, as in fact we all would, wealthy or poor, they should be asked to pay their fair share.
Megan, you were critical of the tax cut law for how it expanded the deficit, and I think I'm recalling your position correctly, that you were also critical of a lot of the tax cuts for individuals just for not being designed in a way that was particularly conducive to economic growth. Given that that was your view, would it be good to repeal some portion of the GOP tax law as part of an infrastructure bill?
Yes, in a limited way. Look, I actually think that in general, the corporate tax rationalization was good. And I think that a lot of things that are on the Democratic agenda are unjustifiable, like the state and local tax deduction. Look, as someone who lives in a high tax city, Washington, D.C., it has hit me personally, and I would certainly love to get my money back. But I don't think that there is any way to justify this deduction, which almost entirely benefits extremely high earners in extremely rich states. So, you know, on that side, look, I think that taxes should rise to pay for more of the spending that we're doing. I also think that, you know, there is a lot of spending that could be cut, but that's a discussion for another day. But my worry actually is almost, and I hate to be the conservative who's attacking everything from the left this week, But I mean, it's sort of ridiculous that they're not raising taxes on any household that doesn't make $400,000 a year. You know, the Democrats are talking about kind of a really ambitious long-term expansion of the welfare state. And the way they want to fund this is by only taxing people who are extremely rich by any measure. I know you don't feel rich because you live in an expensive city, but that living in that expensive city is itself a consumption choice that affords you access to really rich and deep labor markets and all sorts of cultural amenities that people who don't live there and take lower salaries elsewhere don't get. The fact that Democrats are so determined, and perhaps like the fact that they have to pander to people who are by any standard some of the richest people in human history, by saying no, you are struggling too hard, we're never going to raise your taxes, they're at the same time as they are promising this huge expansion of what the government spends money on, is really distressing to me, both because it sort of speaks to a fundamental unseriousness, but also because it suggests that the coalitional politics of maintaining their increasingly top-heavy, political coalition is going to mean that they're going to do the expansion, and they're not going to do what states that actually have those kinds of welfare states do, which is raise big taxes on the middle class so that on net, most people are contributing about as much as they're getting out of the government. That is ultimately how you have to finance those welfare states, because the millionaires and the billionaires, as much fun as it is to talk about whacking them, don't actually have enough money to cover what Democrats say they want to do.
Yeah, so Christine, there's two elements there in the Democratic framing of this push for tax increases that I agree with Megan are odd. One is, at the same time that Democrats are talking about tax increases, they want this big tax cut, or many of them want this big tax cut in the form of fully restoring the federal income tax deduction for state and local taxes paid. That costs about $80 billion a year. So that's not a small provision. It's a really large one. It mostly goes to very high income households, but it also benefits a lot of the people in that bracket Megan is talking about, people who make $200,000 or $300,000 a year, so they're high income but not ultra high income, who live in states with high taxes, and I think by any reasonable standard have a very good standard of living. And if we're going to expand what the government does, I think it would be reasonable to ask those people to pay more instead of trying to give them a tax cut. Now, I know this is controversial within the Democratic Party. I don't think it's clear that there will be a full restoration of the state and local tax deduction, but I do tend to look at that as basically constituent service to affluent Democrats living in high tax states who would like this tax provision that benefits them specifically restored.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I think I actually agree with you on this. It actually speaks to, I think, a broader problem or misconception in kind of the American mind. Surveys show that almost 70% of Americans consider themselves middle class, which just doesn't make logical, or mathematical sense. But we, as Americans and in American politics, really sort of fetishize this idea of like everybody, we're just serving the middle class. The middle class is struggling. We need to help the middle class. Nobody actually wants to identify themselves as wealthy unless they're extremely wealthy. And nobody wants to identify themselves as poor or struggling in America either. It's sort of like a pride thing with us. And so this makes it actually very difficult to make and sell policies that actually do target what would be a real middle class or a real working class, or identify people who actually need help versus want to have more money on hand to take, a vacation or renovate their kitchen, because it becomes politically unpalatable to shrink that definition of the middle class to anything workable. I do think that we are seeing a sort of, the word for it is not polarization, but exactly, I think, what Megan was describing, a sort of urbanization and increasing amount of wealth in the Democratic Party and in Democratic supporters. And the party is, yes, doing constituent citizen service and trying to cater to those roles. I don't think that that's going to be sustainable over the long term. But that is kind of how American politics works these days, with our obsession with, supporting the middle class. And until we, really begin to look at that and sort of redefine what we talk about when we talk about wealth and aid, we're going to continue to have this problem and this false consciousness discussion.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Megan McArdle and Christine Emba of The Washington Post to talk about the effect of 1 year of coronavirus restrictions.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Christine Emba, also a columnist and an editor at The Washington Post. We are around the one-year anniversary of the original coronavirus lockdowns, and what that has meant for education has varied widely across the country. In some areas, kids are back in school with virtually no restrictions. In others, instruction has been fully remote for a year, with attendant disparities in how much children are actually really engaged and learning. And in many places, the situation has been somewhere in the middle. Our guest for this segment is Alec McGillis, a reporter at ProPublica who covers government and politics. Alec recently wrote a feature story about the town of Hobbs, New Mexico, where, as with all public high schools in the state of New Mexico, school buildings were closed from last March at least through this February. Towns right across the border in Texas have been back in full-person instruction for months. Alec looked at how that difference has been impacting the community. Welcome, Alec.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what did you find in Hobbs?
Oh, what I found was incredibly sad. I found a small city of about 40,000 people where the young people were just really struggling. They had no in-person instruction whatsoever. Just a few of the youngest kids had it one day a week. The older kids didn't even have Zoom school. They had they were basically getting a lot of their instruction online asynchronous, which means just sitting there with the online curriculum on their own without even being in the same online space with their classmates. And then they had no sports. They had, this is a town that takes its sports very seriously, especially football. It's, you know, some Friday night lights country. And they, all they had were these very kind of sad weightlifting sessions with small groups in the mornings. That's all that they were allowed. No real throwing, even throwing the football around. The basketball team for a while had to practice without a basketball because the basketball might, you know, spread the virus. That was the fear. Meanwhile, across the border in Texas, in West Texas, right across the border, like half an hour across the border, you had towns with schools completely open all the way up through high school, 5 days a week. They were taking some precautions, including, you know, masks in the hallway, contact tracing for cases. But things were pretty normal. And they were even playing football with fans on Friday nights with limited crowds, but they were making it work. And so the kids on the Hobbs side were not only struggling and feeling like something had been taken away from them and really kind of their youth had been taken away from them in a sense, their these key years, but then they look right across the line and they see this and they wonder why can they do it and we can't. They just couldn't, this made no sense to them.
Your story focuses on a teen suicide that occurred in Hobbs and how that impacted the community. But one thing you note in the story is that when you look at national data on suicide rates for teenagers, there's no indication that there's actually been an increase in that around the country. So I'm wondering how you square, I mean, obviously we can all see the social dislocation that has occurred over the last year and understand why it would be particularly severe for children and teenagers. But how do you square that with not being able to find at least that particular indicator showing up in the data overall?
Well, it's important to note that suicide data lags incredibly. And it's really kind of confounding how much it lags. We only just this past December got the 2019 numbers. So the flat numbers that the piece mentions were only for the early part of 2020, early in the pandemic. We don't have yet any nationwide suicide numbers for the latter half of 2020. One might have expected to see increases if the situation really was wearing on young people. So we're not going to get those numbers for quite a while. It's crazy that it takes so long. In New Mexico, I was able to get New Mexico numbers for New Mexico alone. New Mexico has always had a high suicide rate, including a high teen suicide rate. It's a huge crisis there. It's been for a while. And they came last year, they came in at the same very high number that they'd had for 2019. They did one thing I did not get into in the piece is that they things definitely got worse as 2020 went on in New Mexico. They had the rate for the last 6 months of the year was double the rate for the first 6 months. Nationwide, we're not going to have that metric until basically the end of this year, which is kind of ridiculous. So all we've had to go on nationwide are these other indicators, you know, ER visits, polling on surveys on suicidal ideation, that kind of thing.
Christine, I do feel like what must be an enormous social cost here, and obviously, you know, there are mental health and happiness and well-being factors that obviously are important besides suicide as the most serious one, and it just feels to me that this has been sort of weirdly muted in the conversation about how to respond to the pandemic and what to do about it, in particular all the decisions that have been made around the country about how to conduct schooling. And we've just seen the CDC has announced that they're changing the recommendations in schools for 3 feet of social distancing rather than 6, which will make it operationally a lot easier for more school districts to reopen while complying with CDC guidelines. But I do feel like we're going to look back on this period, and there's going to be a difficult to measure but serious impact on the well-being of children and teenagers that I just feel like has not really been centered in a lot of the conversation this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that new CDC change is just so weird and capricious in some ways. Like, did we just suddenly discover that the virus is, you know, stopped spreading beyond 6 feet and it's just gone down to 3? It kind of highlights the in general capricious nature of some of the rulings that have been handed down, unfortunately, by a disorganized government health center, and why I think people are finding that hard to trust. But that aside, I think one of the reasons why we haven't, you know, focused as much or had as much clarity on this question is simply that, you know, elementary schoolers, middle schoolers, and high schoolers are not really represented in our political process. They don't have a vote. They're not usually public figures. And so while their parents can advocate for them, you know, if they have the time and resources, the voices of children are just in general, you know, not really heard and taken account for in our society. And I really do wonder what the outputs will be.
Look, I mean, I think, obviously, I feel like it's obvious that there must be effects. We should be comfortable with the fact that we won't necessarily ever know whether suicides would have been lower in the absence of a lockdown policy. I'm sure there will be many studies done trying to establish it. Which means, you know, I think we could look at other things, though, where I think it's really a lot more clear, and Alec has done some of the great work on this, that the learning deficits and the kind of fabric of the community are being frayed in ways that suggest that, you know, I get why we pulled kids out of school last spring. We didn't really understand this pandemic, and you know, it wasn't clear how bad it was going to be or how much kids could be hurt by it. But by fall, we really knew that it was pretty safe to have kids in school. And we also knew about the, you know, if it's not important to have kids in school, then why are we spending so much time and so much of their time and so much of everyone's money putting them in school for so many years? And we decided to end that for a bunch of reasons, you know, from teachers unions to frightened parents, that I think in retrospect, we are going to look back and say this was just the biggest mistake that we made in this pandemic, was deciding to not commit to doing what we needed to do in order to keep the schools open and the kids learning.
I think it's important that we don't just focus exclusively on the suicide question. I mean, this piece was in one sense about a suicide, but the suicide, and actually there were 3 in this town among young people over the course of just half a year. But the suicides are the tip of the iceberg. I mean, it's the broader sense of dislocation and isolation that young people are feeling these days. So it's I think that even if we don't see, you know, suicides per se, you know, spiking in 2020, that we should just decide that everything was okay, mental health wise and emotional wise for kids. And I think a lot of parents can speak to that. I do believe we're going to be asking this question for a long time. Why did we make the choice we did on this front? And there's going to have to be a reckoning with it.
I've been talking with Megan McArdle and Christine Emba of The Washington Post and Alec McGillis of ProPublica. We'll be back to talk about Alec's new book about Amazon. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. If you or someone you know may be considering suicide, please contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or the Crisis Text Line by texting HOME to 741-741. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Christine Emba, also a columnist and an editor at The Washington Post. And Alec McGillis, reporter at ProPublica and author of the new book, Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America, is also with us. So, Alec, let's talk about your book. This book is about Amazon, its rise, and the role it has played in reshaping our economy. But your frame is, this book is not just about Amazon. It's about these broad trends in our economy and our society in which Amazon happens to have been a major player. So could you tell us how you came to tell this story? What is the story you're trying to tell through the story about Amazon?
That's right. I actually came to Amazon sort of secondarily with this book. My initial concern, the issue that I've been so worried about and thinking a lot about these last decade or more is regional inequality, you know, the growing gaps between places in America, not just the urban-rural gap that gets talked about so much, but the growing gap between cities, sort of winner-take-all cities and left-behind cities and towns. And it's a gap that's been growing a lot in the last couple of decades. We've always had richer and poorer places, but the gap has gotten a lot bigger, and it's had a big effect on our politics, and it's just... It's an imbalance that's just not good for anyone. It's not good for the winner take all cities that have become hyper prosperous and unaffordable, and you know, dealing with all sorts of issues of displacement and you know, major housing crises and all that congestion, and then on the other end of the spectrum, of course, just you know, the cities dealing with real blight and abandonment and despair and you know, real sense of just having been left behind, and so I was thinking about how to write about this, and the frame I decided to adopt was Amazon, to look at not so much at the company itself, but Amazon's America, everything that falls within the shadow of the company. And the company works as a frame, both because it's so ubiquitous now that it's just a handy way to take you around the country. It's a handy thread to take you around the country because it is kind of everywhere now. But it also works as a frame because it is contributing to this problem, and it's an explanation for it. You know, put simply, one reason we have so much concentration within certain cities, certain regions, is that our economy has gotten so concentrated in certain companies. And so much of the wealth and prosperity and growth and commerce flows to the places where those companies are now based. And so the company really works very well in a way as a frame onto this problem of these glaring regional disparities.
So it seems to me there are two sets of critiques here, and both of them are in your book. One deals directly with Amazon's business practices and the ways it treats employees, competitors, suppliers. And then another is about how its national footprint has been a driver of that inequality trend that you described, that you have some metro areas like Seattle and Washington, D.C. that get lots of high-paying white-collar jobs and housing cost problems that are associated with that. And then you have others like Dayton and Baltimore that lose corporate headquarters, lose sources of middle-class jobs, end up with a bunch of low-paying jobs in Amazon warehouses. And so I guess one question I have for you is, are these fundamentally separate problems with separate remedies in your view? There's this union drive at Amazon that's getting a lot of attention at a warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, where there's an ongoing election about whether those workers should unionize. And so you could imagine a situation in which Amazon has a more unionized workforce that campaigns for and obtains better working conditions, and Amazon becomes an employer that is better for those workers. Does that address this regional inequality issue at all, or is that a completely separate problem?
There, you're right. It's very shrewd insight. I mean, they're separate and related. I would say that the one problem is addressed more by organizing, and it's just really kind of incredible what's unfolding now in Alabama, and if what could kind of follow from that in terms of improving conditions. But then the other problem, the problem of the regional inequality and the concentration, economic concentration, is best addressed by a reinvigorated antitrust approach, which we're also seeing signs of happening in Washington, and that will be very interesting to watch. I do think that they're related to the extent that Amazon's extraordinary dominance. And which, you know, it's hard for us even to grasp, like, just how much bigger it's grown this past year, and just how much, I mean, it was already huge, and now to have added 500,000 employees in just a year, not counting the drivers, half as much additional warehouse space, sales up 40% year over year, it's extraordinary dominance in turn, you know, does contribute to the sort of conditions problem, because it becomes even harder for local governments or even just the local economy to kind of push back at the company when it becomes as dominant and powerful as it is. So there's even less the desperation with which local governments kind of welcome the warehouses and are sort of unlikely to kind of in any way kind of give the company any trouble is that's all the greater given the company's dominance. And so I do think in that sense they are related, but the solutions, the main solutions to each are different. The main solution to the one is the union fight. The main solution to the other is the antitrust.
We're in a slightly awkward position on today's show in that we have two panelists who are employees of the Washington Post, which of course is owned by Jeff Bezos, who is the founder of Amazon. And so I'm going to ask Christine and Megan to put that aside as best as possible. I'll go to Megan first. Is this concentration of employment and retail market share in one large employer, and more broadly consolidation of large corporations, is this a problem in the economy, and is beefed up antitrust an appropriate response to it?
I mean, it depends on for whom you're asking. Look, I think that as an avid consumer of Amazon myself, I have to say, I think that it has on net been extremely good for consumers. And I think actually that for Democrats, it's actually a little interesting for the left, trying to leave aside my employee of Jeff Bezos hat and put on my business columnist hat. I think it's an interesting company for them because in a bit like Walmart, one of the really hard things for the left, and they tend to attribute their kind of failures on the private unionization front to the fact that unionization laws are not tough enough and we need to make the labor law stricter. But in fact, the biggest problem they have is that they're now trying to unionize service companies, and service companies just don't have the margins that like a Ford Motor Company did, right? Where each employee can be producing hundreds of thousands of dollars of value a year for the firm, and therefore, you as a union can get some higher wages for that worker, skim some of it off the top for the costs of running the union, and still leave like basically the company is still making some pretty good money, the workers are making better money, the union's making money. Not to impugn union motives, I'm just saying like they do ultimately at the end of the day have to fund themselves. And the problem is that, like, Walmart, you know, their revenue, excess revenue per employee is more like $7,000. And there's just not a lot of extra value there that the union can claim either for the worker or for the union. And that has made it very difficult to get these industries organized. Amazon comes along and it improves the productivity of retail to the point that you can actually claim some value there, I think. This is not an argument about whether they should. I'm going to stay out of that dispute and just say that you can claim value. I think there is something there for the union to claim. But also, they don't have the problem that those unions now have with manufacturing, which is that manufacturing is mobile. In most cases, it is making something that is a tradable good, which means that it can move to China and you can get cheaper labor and so forth. And so manufacturing clusters are now largely located in China and not in the United States. And in the golden age of left-wing union organizing in the United States in mid-century, they had that kind of in-place control over, you know, it just wasn't feasible for a manufacturer to, say, leave the Great Lakes if they needed a lot of coal and ore, or to leave New York's ports if they needed imported things. And so they tended to be kind of captive industries that you could extract some value from. Eventually they picked up and left, and that left unions less able to organize. Well, Amazon has to be where it is, because Amazon's core business strategy now, it wasn't always, but now, is about getting things to people often same day or next day. And to do that, you need proximity to those people, which means that Amazon, not at the town level, but certainly at the state, even maybe the county level, is kind of a captive player, which means that for all the antipathy that the left wing has expressed towards Amazon, it may be, just as a on an analytical level, their best opportunity in a generation to unionize a big firm and get some value back into private sector labor organizing, which has long been basically moribund.
So Christine, that's interesting, an argument from Megan that Amazon workers have an unusually large amount to gain by unionizing.
Yeah, it is. And I think that, I guess, you know, one could look at that as an upside. I mean, I think that Alec, in his writing and in this book, has just really eloquently, you know, described the ways in which companies, Amazon itself and companies like Amazon, have, you know, sort of strafed the communities that they take part in. You know, yes, they do provide jobs, but often these jobs don't provide a sense of community. They definitely don't, you know, provide modes for upward mobility. The neighborhoods that they locate themselves in often find themselves desiccated. I do think it's interesting, though, and again, I think I sort of say this about many of our discussions, but this is a sort of larger moral quandary. Megan noted that, you know, some of these companies may not have excess revenue for employees and unions to strip off. That said, they do seem to have a lot of excess revenue for dividends and revenue for CEOs and upper management, and revenue that they can use to lobby cities and towns to either place a warehouse, which tends to, you know, run an area down, or place HQ 2 or 3, which then often will inflate housing prices, cause gentrification, et cetera, in different communities. And I think we need to continue to ask, you know, taking off or keeping on my employee of the Jeff Bezos-owned Washington Post hat, what do we expect from these companies? What do we expect from the corporations that are taking over larger and larger parts of our lives? Like, I mean, it's nice, I guess, that you can order something and get it the next day. But what are the trade-offs in terms of, you know, our society, our culture, the way that our country hangs together on a more metaphysical level than just a convenience level for allowing these companies to do what they do?
Alec, would workers be better off with a more fragmented retail industry, which I assume would be an outcome of more aggressive antitrust enforcement? I mean, large employers tend to pay higher wages and better benefits than smaller employers. I think Megan makes a good argument there that Amazon's competitive advantages increase the ability of a union, if it is to form at the company, to actually, you know, extract significant concessions for workers, because there's money available to get it. So I look at that and And I wonder whether we really would want to have a more fragmented retail industry. I mean, Amazon, their starting wage now for workers is $15 an hour. A lot of the competitors who could pick up market share if they were smaller pay less than that.
Well, there's actually a whole debate about that. It's been a you know, very intense debate these last few years about Amazon's pay versus sort of, it all depends on what you're comparing it against. There's, you know, there in a lot of places that Amazon comes in, where it comes in, the other warehouses, if you're comparing against other warehouses, warehouse jobs, those jobs are often slightly better paid. Noam Shiver had a good piece about this in the Times, that the $15 an hour looks good if you're comparing it against, say, a low-wage retail clerk who's been sort of displaced by Amazon, who might have just been making $12 or $13 an hour at the register, but that in fact other actual warehouses in some of these communities, you're making $17, $18, $20 an hour. So it does kind of depend on how you're making that comparison. The I really come back, to the antitrust as being just a more overarching, question of sheer dominance and what it's done to our landscape. I mean, I think my principal concern really was the just how unhealthy it is to have this extraordinary concentration, both in certain companies within certain sectors, and then in our economic geography, and just the what our cities now look like and what they're like to live in, and the role that this rising economic concentration has played in that kind of sorting, which is so deeply unhealthy. And the fact that one of the things that I found most sort of confounding in the housing debate is in some of these cities that are doing very well, the sort of winner take all cities, is that we have this kind of endless debate about should we have more supply in these cities or more rent control. It's this vicious debate sort of within the left in these cities, and which completely misses the broader context that one reason you have these affordability crises in these cities is that you have such incredible concentrated wealth and prosperity in them, and that if that were dispersed somewhat more broadly across the country, as it was not that long ago, that you would not end up with such an acute crisis. The fact that we have a city like Washington has grown increasingly unaffordable. 20,000 Black residents, by one estimate, displaced in the last decade. Your average kind of townhouse going for $700,000-$900,000, while just up on the road and 40 miles away in Baltimore, we're demolishing, in my city here, we're demolishing hundreds of row houses at a time, is kind of crazy. And then meanwhile, what happens when Amazon decides where to put its $25,000 high paid jobs? For HQ2, it puts them in Washington. So it's ultimate rich get richer, winner take all. It's bad for everyone at both ends of the spectrum. And that to me is the real unhealthiness, real imbalance, real kind of out of whackness, off kilterness that has been created here. It's the worker pay is very important, but it goes way beyond that.
Do you see any opportunities here related to the aftermath of the pandemic? I know there's an epilogue in the book about this, where as we've seen people work, many of these white collar workers working remotely for the last year, some talk at a lot of companies about people doing this permanently. Is that a way to spread the prosperity from these companies out more, make it less important which cities they're based in, and inject some of that prosperity in more broadly across the country?
I'm certainly hopeful, but the more time goes on, the more signs are actually not so encouraging. To the extent that these moves seem to be happening, this kind of anecdotes we're getting about these moves, they seem to be happening from the very, very expensive winter cities like San Francisco to somewhat less expensive winter cities like Austin or Boulder. Rise in real estate values in the suburbs of the winter cities. So, Fairfield County and Westchester County and the New Jersey suburbs of New York. So people making that move, or people making the move to pretty places, to coastal Maine towns or up the Hudson River or the mountain resort towns out west. But there's very little sign of any kind of, at scale move happening to to the truly affordable cities that could truly use a surge of new interest, you know, people to the Akrons or Eries or Rochesters or Buffaloes or that sort of move. And then on top of that, you're seeing signs from the companies themselves that they are making no move to leave the winner take all cities. Seattle, Amazon just announced that they're going to build out for 25,000 more employees across the lake in Bellevue, you know, the Tony suburb of Seattle. Amazon's putting couple thousand more people into the old Lord and Taylor headquarters in Manhattan. Facebook, you know, bought up space in the Penn Station complex in Manhattan. Amazon's putting thousands more people in Boston. So it does seem like that hope of dispersal won't come to very much.
Alec MacGillis is a reporter at ProPublica covering government and politics, and his new book is called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America. Alec, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We have reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, it's your soapbox.
I would like to talk about the effect of 1 year of coronavirus restrictions on our clothes. I have started shopping as I have realized that I cannot simply keep buying more pajamas indefinitely, and eventually I'm going to have to leave my house. And I am shocked by what I have been seeing in fashion shows and on retail websites. Look, I get it. We've realized how comfy pajamas are. We forgot how to pull on our skinny jeans if we can even find them at the bottom of the pile of pajamas. We're not used to planning wardrobes around how they look rather than how they feel. And many of us have gained what one of my colleagues dubbed the COVID-19. That is no excuse for the series of ambulatory tents that I have seen parading through publications, on websites. This is, folks, I went through this in the 80s. This is a terrible, terrible idea. No one looks attractive in a giant muumuu. We have to, if we are ever going to get America back to normal, we need to have something that does not look like we are not only joining the circus, but actually having it inside our clothes.
Christine Embo, what's on your mind?
Make America great again with more tight pants. No, I am going to rant about Joe Biden and the demon weed. So after saying that marijuana use wouldn't be disqualifying for White House positions when the Biden administration was scrambling to hire, now dozens of staffers, mostly young ones, have been suspended or asked to resign or work remotely because they voluntarily disclosed marijuana use on their intake forms. So this seems terribly unfair, first of all, to tell people that they can and should be honest and then later on ding them for it. This also seems like it'll prime people to lie. In the screening process, at least, you'll be recruiting for unscrupulousness and weeding out, as it were, many talented people who might come from the growing number of states and localities that have helpfully, and I think reasonably, legalized marijuana. Look, government has been struggling for a long time to recruit talented people to public service over higher-paying, less scrutinizing roles. This is not going to help. This news also comes on the heels of Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts saying in a press conference that if you legalize marijuana, you're going to kill your kids, and Fox News conservatives going completely insane over the raunchy rap song WAP. It kind of feels like we've gone back to the 90s, but we shouldn't. Government needs to get with the times. We have many bigger things to worry about than the spurious fears of reefer madness emanating from the White House.
For my rant, one by one, states are announcing when they're opening vaccination to all adults, and every state is supposed to do this by May 1st. Not very long from now, getting a vaccine appointment won't be an ordeal. It will be fairly easy, and that's great. But I want to talk about the step after that. I don't want vaccine appointments to just be easy to get. I want people confronted with opportunities to get the vaccine all the time, no appointment needed, in places they're already going. And that's going to happen pretty soon, too. Dr. Ashish Jha, Dean of Brown's School of Public Health, tells me he thinks people will be able to walk into a CVS and ask for a COVID shot, much like a flu shot, by mid-June. just a few months from now. Now, I'm not saying you should wait until mid-June to get vaccinated. You should get vaccinated as soon as you can. But when we talk about vaccine hesitancy, we're not just talking about people who are adamantly opposed to getting the vaccine. We're talking about people who are ambivalent about it, unsure about it, maybe not super motivated to refresh over and over and over again in order to get a vaccine. And one factor that will cause more and more people like that to get vaccinated will be these extremely easy ad hoc opportunities to get the vaccine. I want someone who just went to CVS for a quart of milk to be able to look at a sign and say, hey, maybe I should get my COVID shot now. I want people to who go to their doctor's office for purposes other than COVID to have their doctor say, hey, I have Johnson & Johnson vaccine here. Do you want it now? That's going to get us to as large a fraction of the population as possible getting a COVID vaccine, and it should be the reality just a few months from now. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Megan McArdle, Christine Emba, and Alec McGillis. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay and recorded and mixed by Kat Yore and Michael Stark. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.